Hello, you're watching Talking Europe. As the EU political season gets back into full swing, member states are confronted by daunting challenges. In the last few days, they've revisited the thorny question of providing security guarantees to Ukraine, which of course means dealing with the notoriously mercurial US President Donald Trump. Transatlantic tensions are obvious, both politically and on the trade side of things, despite an EU-US agreement on tariffs struck at the end of July. We're going to take a closer look at the geopolitical and economic headwinds faced by the EU with our guest, Arantxa González-Laya, the Dean of the Paris School of International Affairs at Sciences Po. She's a former foreign minister of Spain and a former senior official at the World Trade Organization and at the United Nations. Welcome back to the program.
Real pleasure.
So as you're based here in Paris, I thought we might start a bit with some French issues and the political uncertainty and the economic problems that France is facing. And of course, there's a big question about whether France is going to get a grip on its 2026 budget. What do you think could happen if France fails to deal with this budget deficit?
I think it's very important that France gets it right for the French citizens and, you know, perhaps following the good old tried method of sitting down, including with social actors, with trade unions, with entrepreneurs, different political forces, maybe the avenue. But I worry not only for France, I also worry for Europe, because the weakening of France due to its own inability to manage its political system has a spillover effects on the European Union, because France is a systemic country to the European Union. So I do hope that when French leaders across the political spectrum, business and trade unions, discuss and decide what to do, they keep this in mind, because the headwinds internationally, the aggressivity of our neighbor, Russia, the building up of military might on China and the volatility on the US is putting Europe to the test.
So it's not a time for France to become the sick man of Europe, neither economically nor geopolitically.
Certainly not.
Let's talk a bit about Ukraine-related matters. I mentioned the talks held in Paris a few days ago of the Coalition of the Willing, as it's been called. But of course, what they're talking about is measures if and when there's a ceasefire in place, and there's no sign of that at all. Russia and Ukraine are obviously miles apart in their positions. Do you think then that it's really that useful to be talking about these things now?
Well, first, factual element. The US had promised that Vladimir Putin was going to sit down with Ukrainian President Zelensky to negotiate peace. The reality is that Putin lied to Trump, and there is no peace negotiation whatsoever. So that is the starting point. If this is not happening, and if Russia, on the contrary, is doubling down, I think the game plan in Europe is to support as much as we can Ukraine militarily. I mean, of course, on the civilian side too, on the budget, on the economy, but also militarily, help train the army, help equip the army, help with arms and ammunition that will help Ukraine defend itself. Beyond that, obviously, we have to prepare and strengthen the ability of Ukraine in a future negotiation. And that means discussing what kind of security guarantees Europe would want to put on the table to help Ukraine, and keeping as much as we can the US on board. And this is, you know, to the question from the US that Europe was a free rider, I think the answer from Europe is no, we're not. We want to be an actor. We're ready to be that. And we are putting what it takes to get there.
It's interesting that in that answer, you didn't say anything about actual European boots on the ground, which is the most contentious element. Are you then quite pessimistic about the possibility that European nations or members of this coalition will actually send even, let's say, a reassurance force far away from the line of contact?
No, I mean, it's the security guarantees that Europe would provide have to be serious enough to deter the aggression of Russia. And that's how I would frame it. And then it's just a question of discussing what these security guarantees would need to be. But let's not, you know, let's start the house from a very solid foundations rather than from the roof.
Let's talk a bit about then, you mentioned Donald Trump and the whole relationship with him that Europe is sort of trying to navigate. Of course, we did see this deal on tariffs, but it was not a reciprocal. So in other words, it's the US collecting duties on these European tariffs, and Europe is not reciprocating with the same level of collecting duties. Do you think Europe has essentially surrendered on trade?
I don't call this a trade agreement. A trade agreement like the one the European Union has negotiated with Mercosur or with Canada or with Japan or with Korea or with so many others, in that there is quid pro quo, and that there is basically reducing as much as possible and, if possible, eliminating obstacles to trade between the blocs. This is not what Europe and America did in July. What Europe did was accept to pay a price to the U.S. for the U.S. remaining engaged in Ukraine. And let's call it for what it is. Let's say that this is what we did because we decided to put the defense and the security of the European continent, starting with Ukraine, but also that of Europe, ahead of the economy.
So fear of losing Trump on the Ukraine issue sort of motivated the EU to make these concessions on tariffs, is basically.
So fear of not being in a position to provide the European citizens with enough security. Fear of not being in a position to protect the European citizen led to having to pay a serious price on the economic front. Now, what lesson do we draw from this is what matters. We are now 1 month after this negotiation. What lesson should Europe take? Is that if we are weak geopolitically, we will not be able to exert our trade and economic power. So if we want to also decide on our economic power, on our trade power, on our competitiveness, we have to strengthen the European Union from the security and defense point of view.
And in contrast to the, quote, agreement, although you said it's not really one, with the US, the tentative deal with Mercosur, the South American countries, that looks like much more of a classic trade agreement with mutual barriers falling. I guess you're probably quite in favor of the EU continuing that kind of agreement with partners in the world.
It provides opportunities to our exporters, agricultural exporters, industrial exporters, services exporters that generate jobs in Europe through international trade, provide them opportunities that are being denied to them by more difficulties, for example, on the American market. But I'm also eager to see this because this is also part of the geopolitical strengthening of the European Union, building alliances with partners around the world that, like the European Union, don't want an international order based only on might. They also like the idea that there should be right. And that is for the EU to have the capacity and the power to do that. It needs to team up with others that see it like the Europeans see it. And this is what this Mercosur agreement is also about.
Of course, there's plenty of opposition inside Europe, not least by farmers in this country, in France, to Mercosur. But that's really for another day. What I also want to talk to you about a bit is the whole question of Gaza, because obviously it is still very much something that is dividing the EU at the moment. But a few days ago, Belgium became the latest Western country to recognize the state of Palestine, or it says it will do that at the UN General Assembly. So there is clearly a trend here of more countries recognizing the state of Palestine. Do you think, though, that is ultimately just a symbolic step? Or does it have anything practical that follows?
It's not just a symbolic step. Europe stands for a two-state solution, which is the only solution for the moment that is on the table, and that it wants to see Palestine and Israel living side by side in peace and security, both of them. But of course, this does not stop the horrendous suffering that is taking place at the moment on the ground on civilians, on Palestinian civilians, but also on Israeli civilians that are hostage. And this is what where Europe has to be very careful, because it is colliding with the values that the European Union stands for.
That's why I used the word symbolic, because if you look at concrete things that some EU member states actually wanted to do, like exclude Israel from some research and startup programs and things like that, things that might actually have some real influence, there's no European consensus on pushing forward with those things.
More needs to be done to stop this inhumane behavior on civilians. But the difficulty we face is acting in the short term to put an end to this horrible suffering on humans, this inhumanization of citizens, and also work for the medium to long term with this two-state solution that Spain, together with Ireland, Slovenia, and Norway, a year and a half ago, decided to take the lead on, and that it's very good to see others like France or Belgium or Canada or Australia, to also see not as a gesture that is against Israeli citizens, but it's a gesture that wants to stand for a two-state solution.
Yeah, and Malta is also in that group of countries I should have mentioned. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being on the programme. Arantxa González-Laya, the Dean of the Paris School of International Affairs at Sciences Po. And in part two of Talking Europe, I'll be continuing to discuss the big issues facing the European Union as this European political season starts up again with my panel of experts here in Paris.